Hello, everybody. It's Jughead, and welcome to this show. I much appreciate you listening to the podcast. This is my 11th year, and I think it's going smashingly. If you are a longtime listener of this show and would like to help out, please donate to the show. You can do that a few different ways. You can just go to PayPal, and if you have an account, you just look me up. It's jugheadsbasement@gmail.com, and you can give anywhere from 0.1 cents to $6 trillion. I don't know if they do $6 trillion through PayPal, but give it a try and see if you have $1 trillion. If you do, then you should join the Patreon and become a Patreon member at $2, $5, and $10 tiers. Every month you donate that amount to the show. You can do that for a full year at one time and just get it out of the way. Or you can pay monthly. And you get things for that. You get shit in the mail. You get free videos of all the interviews that I've done, where the regular podcast audience just gets the audio. You usually get those in advance, which is really nice too. You can put them on in the background while you're painting, like my friend Ryan Singer does. Or you can do other things. You can put them on while you're jogging and look at the video and crash into things like stumps. But be careful. I am not liable. Also, you can do things that are non-monetary related. You can share the podcast with your friends or ghosts or training wheels or large words. Enough of that. You can find out all this information if you go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. I had a great time, really, talking to this fella. So here it is. Now you're listening to Punchin' Air by the Meanies off their 2015 record, It's Not Me, It's You. Hello everybody and welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode 171 of Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests. This week with Link Meanies of The Meanies, Bag Full of Bees, and more. In this episode, we talk to Link about such things as the open letter about AI, and Link and my abilities to turn on a computer, Rick Springfield and other bands from Australia, Link admits he used to be a miserable bastard, wounds acquired on stage, emotional music and our band's influences, plus much, much eeny, meenies, miney, more, more. Let's do it! Hey, did you hear that recording in progress voice?
I did. That was outstanding.
Am I going to be able to see you, or is this
I don't know. Hold on. Do I need to? I'm fucking used. Oh, start video.
Oh, you got it. You got it. Yep. You did it.
Oh, God. I always get so anxious with technology.
Well, welcome to the modern age.
It's not what I expected. I thought it was going to be more like the Jetsons.
Yeah, there's no moving sidewalks yet, but we got the internet and the AI.
I keep reading about all these AI specialists warning us about, they've sort of created the monster, and now they're warning us about it. So
yeah, there's a letter circulating that like hundreds of scientists and philosophers and stuff have signed.
Yeah,
just telling like Google and people to just put on the brakes a little bit. It's interesting.
More than 1,100 signatories, including Elon Musk, Steve Wozniak, and Tristan Harris of the Center for Human Technology, have signed an open letter that was posted Tuesday, March 28, 2023, that calls on all AI labs to immediately pause for at least 6 months the training of AI systems more powerful than GPT-4.
But what? I haven't really delved into it that much. But is there reasoning, kind of like along the lines of the kind of Terminator kind of?
That is some people. Some people, it's just they're mostly saying it just needs to have more thought put into it. It can't just be given to corporations to, you know, to be fooling people, to be used, abused. A lot of it is it going to be sentient? Does it have to be treated as some sort of being? But there is also that element that's like, well, almost like that movie, I forget what it was called, Her, I think, where it's like where the machines just realize they don't need us anymore, you know, and they just go away.
Well, I often wonder, like, essentially, if you're creating a sentient machine, isn't it going to be a psychopath? Because, I mean, how do you program empathy in a machine? But I guess it's possible.
That's one of the problems. They're also one of the problems is if you give something directives. You know, life is a lot of, there's a lot of chaos in life. And, you know, you can't to give a directives for even a simple thing is saying like, be kind to dogs or something.
Yeah. It weighs
there's
up
many,
all these
like, yeah, there's like
yeah, yeah.
thousands of different directives. To
yeah.
Give
yeah.
Thing, so
when you say be kind to dogs, do you mean wipe them out? You know?
Yeah. Cause that might be the kindest thing to do. They are treated.
So.
Yeah. Or they're not treated very well because they shouldn't be owned by humans. So maybe we should get rid of the humans.
So kill the humans. Oh, sounds like a plan.
See, Link, I told you we could talk for an hour. See, that's
John in the future here, in the correspondences between Link and me, he had said that he couldn't foresee himself filling more than 20 to 30 minutes.
Well, this is my kind of interview. I just like go on tangents and random shit.
Yeah, that's I do. I just so you a little bit of insight to me because you may not know. I do a lot of notes. I am someone that's studying, but I've also been involved in like theatrical improvisation and taught for years in theater and stuff. And I just, what I like to do, what's worked for me is I write all this down and I refer to it and I'll keep us on track. So I'll let us go off. But I also like just let whatever happens in the moment happen. And I call it active listening. That's kind of my journalistic approach.
I like it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'll let you in on a little something. I'm in Japan and that's why I'm doing a lot of Australian interviews now because it's easier because the time zones are similar. But I have a friend here who's lived here like 15 years and he just loves music. And he, you know, he introduced me to Rage, you know, the video TV show you got there.
Yeah.
Introduced me to a lot of a band. So I was already a big fan, like ever since I was, I don't know, right out of high school, I was like Hoodoo Guru is like one of my favorite bands.
Cool.
So I immediately like clung to Australian bands beyond Rick Springfield, you know.
Yeah.
even though his Comic Book Heroes record is pretty good.
There's times when real people let me down, when the temperature falls to zero. I curl up by the fire with a good book, and for a while I am a superhero.
I haven't heard any of his solo stuff. I only know the he played in Zoot, didn't he? The Australian band. That kind of 60s, early 70s band.
But anyway, I just want to know that it's exciting to me to talk to a lot of bands from Australia right now. So I had did one with Jay Wally from Friends of Rom, and then he dropped your names and you guys were playing together. And I was like, oh, that's the Meanies is one of my friends, one of his favorite bands. So I was like, oh, I gotta talk to you.
Nice, lovely chap.
Yeah, yeah. Other things I discovered too is that we basically started recording records around the same time. I think I was 87, and you might have been.
I started playing probably around that time. I play 86, 87, but probably my first record was recorded in about 89, I think.
Yeah, 88, 89 is, I think, what I saw. I guess I just want to go back to that time period because a lot of my fans I don't know. They listen. They come to the show for a little bit of history. And I know Australia in general has always been hard to hit the like international market because it seems like such a separate world to a lot of people.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, it's if you want to sort of like keep current and keep your record selling, you've got to be touring all the time. So it's kind of hard to and expensive to do that when you're in Australia. I mean, I guess somewhere like Japan or whatever is kind of like only a 10-hour flight or whatever. But get, you know, so going to Europe or America, it's kind of pretty costly.
There's one article I read that talks about how you were like the kings of the all ages shows. Was that like not very popular before you guys and you sort of clung on to that? Or do you see that as an actual fictional, I mean, a nonfiction statement?
I mean, I think there was plenty of other bands that did well. I think Wally, our manager, was just sort of pretty good at marketing and stuff. So we just got a lot of t-shirts out there. So that's probably where that came from. But look, it's, well, I don't think, I mean, the people who take credit for that would be like Manic Promotions and Push and all those kind of, all those people who put on, like, created a really good network of all ages shows around Australia. I mean, you used to be able to go on a line to Sydney and do shows along the way, sort of thing. You know? Like now, it's kind of like we pretty much just play the capital cities. There are some shows you do out of the way, but for the most part, we just play the capitals nowadays. But that was such an amazing time for music because that all had a carry on effect to the overage kind of scene too. It's just a very healthy biosphere or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. It's kind of similar to the American one was like the college radio scene sort of like took over the mainstream radio in that sort of a similar way. Yeah.
No, but it was just, it really was good, and it just, I don't, doesn't seem to have that kind of it doesn't have that organic kind of carry on to the outrageous crowd. It doesn't seem to be that connection that there used to be. I don't really know though. I feel a bit out of touch, but
Yeah, I got to ask myself that question a lot too. I've actually been trying to interview a lot of more younger bands because my instinct sometimes as an older musician is like, yeah, it's just, it's not the same as it used to be or it's more difficult. And sometimes it's accurate, but sometimes it's just age and I don't know what's really going on.
I think it's always going to be the case that there's pros and cons, you know, with that sort of stuff. I think it's harder for young. I mean, from my limited perspective, I think it's harder for young bands now because there just seems to be so much competition and like the window for any like releasing a record or you know for anything is so small. It feels like it's so small. Like when you used to put an album out back in the day, it's like the window for interest was felt like it was like a month and a half or you know. Whatever, now it feels like it's a week.
I actually correlated a lot of what's going on in music to me. I think I said this a couple of years ago. It reminded me of like in the early 70s when they talked about like one hit wonders. And I used to go, well, all those bands don't really consider themselves one hit. I mean,
No.
they went out there to be a band. So I felt like that might have been a similar time where like there was so much going on that you had your moment in the limelight and then you were just like tossed aside by the machine.
I was going to say that was more the record companies doing that as opposed to now just the social media is the kind of issue that that's so, you know, just such an influx and technology, such an influx of bands that it's just like, I kind of, I'm just happy to kind of like roll along and do my thing now without any, aspirations for success now because I just don't think it's possible now for me, you know, I don't really understand how to work the social media to the best effect. I mean, there's kids out there who know exactly what they're doing, and you feel like a bit of a dying breed. But I'll never stop doing music. But I'm sort of happy just to make good music and carry along.
Yeah, I talked to my friend Jarrett, who's in this band Bowling for Soup, who had like a big hit because they did a song for an animated series, Phineas and Ferb.
Oh yeah, right, I've heard of that.
Yeah, they made it really big. But then he talks about how he has to go out there every day and write something on the internet, some or Instagram or something. And to me, that just doesn't sound like a living. It's like
No.
having to do
It
that every day, you know?
sounds stressful, doesn't it? It's just
Yeah,
like
it does.
it's like just keeping your head above water, trying not to drown, you know.
Exactly. Link, I want to take it back a little bit, but I love this talk, but I do want to hit some of the earlier stuff. Like one of the things I'm just curious about what it bands in that time, like what we did, where we just went out in a van, booked our own tours. Did you I always am fascinated with how Australia is so much more difficult to do that because everything's so far apart. But did you actually have those days of just hopping in a van and driving around?
We used to drive. We did lots of drives to, all the capital of Sydney, Adelaide, Brisbane, not Perth, of course, because that's just too far. But and that road, particularly going up the coast to Sydney and Brisbane, that was really, or to Sydney, it was really treacherous. That road, or the highway all the way, was oncoming traffic all the way. Now they have separate roads, and you'd go. I remember going through a place called Gunning every time we drove up, and there was like a little sign, and every time we went past, there'd be another, person killed on this sign
Oh man.
the counter would tick over.
Oh.
I used to fucking hate it.
I guess that's it's a related question because I mean when I think back of those days, I would say I was always scared, like going through the mountains of like California, Nevada, and worried about the brakes going out. One time we had a problem where every time we put on the brakes, our headlights would go off. And we didn't know why, because we didn't know anything about cars. Or it just turned out that there's a battery cable loose, but like
All right.
it's,
Oh, that's terrifying.
but what I was getting at is I don't think I ever really hated it, so I didn't have that
Well,
experience.
I didn't hate the touring. I was scared on the on that road is what I meant. I was a pretty miserable bastard back in those days, so I didn't have a lot of joy. And I was always pretty angry and got pretty manic on tour, and I was probably very annoying. Oh no, I know I was very annoying. I'd like to think I'm not now, but that's it depends on who you ask, I guess.
Do you, I wonder about this because I had a singer, Ben for the Screeching Weasel, who had anxiety and hated touring, but he was really good at it because something about being on stage made him anxious enough to be more like outgoing. And we would often say he was like the punk rock Don Rickles because if something happened to the audience, he was on it because he had to deal with it or else the anxiety would be too much. And I'm not saying you come from that place, but from seeing your videos and hearing talk about you, it sounds like you were very active and still are from the video I see now, very active front man. I mean, we are older, so it's harder. But so
With
you
caveats.
so was there something about being on stage that let it go, or did you were you dealing with anxiety that way, or is it?
No, I was a very insecure person and very anxious, and suffered with depression as well, like a lot of musicians. And that, it did come out on stage, definitely. Like I'd get pretty crazy, lacerations and just doing fucking stupid shit. I don't know how I'm not dead, but it was a way to, I guess, it's the only time you kind of felt normal in a way. It sounds strange, but all the, I don't know how to put it, but it definitely made for a good show, whatever it was,
Did that perpetuate? Is it one of those like looking in a mirror type things where it perpetuates it, or an echo chamber where like you do that on stage and then you're actually it's getting a reaction and so you do it
Of
more?
course. Oh, totally. And particularly more so back in the day. Now it's just kind of like muscle memory. You just sort of do it because you've been doing it for so many years. But back then, there was definitely, if you weren't getting the reaction you wanted, you'd go harder, sort of thing. You're a lot more desperate, I guess. Whereas now, I enjoy it now, like so much more than I did back then because I don't have that desperation or insecurity. It's just fun, if I do it now, So, I wish I had have enjoyed it back then as much as I do now, But maybe I wouldn't have done those shows if I had have,
Well, that's a thing you can't really go back and see, and then that's a part of you. I really am structuring this where like I think your last couple records, at least the last two, are really great. So don't think that I'm just dealing with the past
No,
and
no,
knowing that we're going to
no.
get there, but I still
Before
want
you go
to.
any further, I actually like to think of the last two records as our first and second record because as much as there's songs, we still play old songs. We do always play old songs. To me, they're the first kind of complete records that I'm sort of more consistent. And in particular, the last one, even the one before that had some old songs on there. So to me, the continuity is not as good as the last record, which I was written from start to finish kind of thing. And just more consistent, better lyrics, better structure, just better songs,
Yeah, it's funny because I did a deep dive of Friends of Rome because I didn't know that band before I interviewed him. It was just Fat Records approached me, and I was like, "Oh, okay, I'll do it." And their later records too are, I mean, he admits too, are great too. I love seeing that because often it's the other reverse way, you know, like people are excited about the first records and then they lose interest.
Well, I mean, people may be with us. I don't know. But I think bands always think their last record is their best one, but quite often. But it's funny because it's the music industry is one of the a weird kind of industry in the way that as a trade, there's not, if you're a carpenter, for instance, the longer you do your trade, the more respect you get. And it's kind of almost the opposite in music, you know, unless you've hit a certain threshold. Yeah. If you don't get past that certain threshold, then you're kind of, I mean, there's certain bands that, you know, will keep going because they've already attained that level. Whereas bands like ourselves who are kind of like, you know, I don't know what you call as cult bands, you're probably always kind of struggling to against the old records. I don't know. But you get those bands that become big too, and like it's like the early records don't even exist, you know, because they get a whole new crowd. And
oh, you know, one of the ones that I even brought up with Jay Wally was that I interviewed both Dimitri and Keith Morris from Off, and it's just exciting to me to see. I had talked to a couple other people about this. I don't know whether it was the pandemic. Some people say it was the pandemic, but there's something that kicked the asses of a lot of like older gentlemen of our scene into like hyper mode.
It's weird,
really great stuff.
I think I don't know what that phenomenon was all about, but I don't know whether the older bands handle it better, that the whole thing better.
Well, I'm going to dig back a little bit further because one of the things related to here I'll go to this one, because you do your first record in Australia and then the second one you actually do in Seattle right around the time like the grunge scene was sort of bubbling up. I mean, even we were right around that, we were recording in Berkeley and you guys were like up in Seattle around that same time.
Right. So okay. What,
did you book a tour around that? Did you specifically want to record in America?
No, I think it's more of a case of the recording was booked around the tour. We had a European tour. And in hindsight, it maybe could have been booked a little better because there was like, then we had to wait in Seattle for a week and then got to Germany and had to wait there for 2 weeks in Hamburg and I had no money. So it was a really miserable time and it was cold and, you know, it's like I had no money to go out and even get drunk, you know. If it had been booked a little closer to the tour, it would have been perfect. But I just remember that being bloody horrible. Recording session was great with Conrad Uno. Yeah.
The person that Link just mentioned was Conrad Uno. He is an American record producer and founder of the independent record label Pop Llama. He's worked with such bands as Young Fresh Fellows, Mudhoney, Fastbacks, Monomen, Sonic Youth, Bratmobile, the Presidents of the United States of America, Super Suckers, The Smugglers, Groovy Ghoulies, Scared of Chaka, The Posies, The Wannabes, many others, and of course The Meanies with the record 10% Weird.
Yeah, so that was fabulous, but the rest of it kind of sucked. I never really, particularly back then, never really liked the long tours. There's always tension and fights, and you know, and I was pretty unstable and probably very annoying to be on tour with.
I don't know. I had this question here, then maybe I'll bring it up here because I wondered about that because I think often about the Australia, the distance away, and dealing with that, and like a lot of bands that I've come to like through my friend Ben, like I never would have heard of outside of Australia, but then also you and a couple of the bands reaching out towards America and recording there. I was wondering if you ever felt at some point in your career that there was sort of an international community. Like, did you feel part of something international at some point?
I think the biggest connection we had was with Spain. We've got a lot of good memories touring Spain and the last probably two or three times we've been to Europe, we've pretty much only toured Spain. So, you know, we couldn't get arrested in the rest of Europe the last couple of times we went. We did have a tour that was going to take us to, like, Germany and France. What, the last time around, then COVID hit and that got cancelled. And then, you know, once again, just went to Spain. So, but, you know, that's all right, you know. I absolutely love Spain. I lived there for quite a few years. I was married and lived there, and so I have a great connection with the place.
Yeah, I just recently saw, I think it was in Madrid, which is one of my favorite places to play in Europe too. I think I saw a show that you guys had played there. It seemed pretty active. Like you seemed pretty happy to be there.
I'd like the Madrid. I lived in Barcelona. To me, Madrid's like a much better rock and roll town than Barcelona. As much as I love Barcelona, but the fun house places like that, legendary. It's like they're like the Tote in Australia. No, it's I just love the people. I think there's a similarity in attitude with Spanish, but Australians and Spanish people, you know.
Yeah, the thing that I noticed when my second band that I played there with, I did things really different. I got like a female trained choir singer, and we were an acoustic
Oh,
electric
wow.
punk band. So it was,
We
so we so we struggled a lot because people were expecting me to come out of the gate doing the same thing I had been doing for 20 years. And I was like, I'm
It's
gonna just.
hard to fucking get past people's perceptions, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I was kind of playing with it. I was kind of like I hate that I have this, but I have that sort of fuck you sort of attitude about that stuff. But Spain loved it. They were
Oh,
all about
really?
it, you know. And that's
That's
why,
awesome.
yeah, because they seemed a little bit more open to that. I don't know, outside of, you know, they love their metal or their punk and their rock, but they seemed a little bit more open to something strange or different coming out.
More open than other places in Europe, or
I thought so, yeah, when I
yeah,
played there.
right, yeah. I know they really love Australian stuff. And it's probably easier for an Australian band, as it would be probably for a band from anywhere. It's probably easier if there's a perception of you being a certain kind of artist, and you do something that's quite different. It's probably easier to go to another country and do full stop. But definitely think so with Australia.
Listening to your music, obviously there's like there's the Ramones influences and all the influences that came from the Ramones, you know. There's a lot of like 60s and 70s sprinkled in there. I think even like, I don't know how you feel, like Pete Townshend references, but not
Oh,
specifically
definitely.
who, but Pete Townshend.
It's definitely 60s. 60s has always been my favorite era of music. It's kind of like strange that I sort of got into doing a punk sort of band, because there's a lot, a big part of me that would have much preferred to do something along the lines of that sort of power garage kind of 60s kind of that sort of sound. But it's just there's no accounting for why you take go one direction or the other. But definitely in the songs, I think in the melodies and whatever with meanies and everything I do, there's that 60s, 70s influence. There's a song, Buffalo Free, which is probably not a typical meanie song, but it's to me, it sounds like it should be a Who song, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot on the new one that I always think of, like my generation type period of Who
Oh,
that
okay,
seems
cool.
really, yeah, that I really dug. I really dug a lot of that. A lot of
Nice.
that, what do they call it? That Brit rock that came out around that time. And well, maybe there's just something in you that, I mean, I don't know. Not, you know, Pete Townshend, some people call him like the grandfather of punk, like before even Iggy Pop and stuff like that. Do you think maybe this anxiety of yours and the this love of pop music just pushed it more into like a punky sort of aggressive feel?
I don't know. I think I was probably, oh, how old would I have been when the meanie started? About 18,
Yeah.
17 or 18. And I was probably going through that sort of like punk phase and like liking a lot of those sort of bands. Whereas before, I'd been into kind of all different sort of stuff, but it was that small kind of era where I sort of obsessed about that sort of music more. And that's probably just at that point is when the meanie
Right.
started. If it had
Yeah.
been 2 or 3 years later or a year earlier, like I did bands before that, like that were more sort of, sort of guitar-y kind of garagey sort of stuff, I guess. And it just so happens that band started then, and it was the one that became successful. Well,
At the time, did you think that that put you in a box, or were you quite content just to do that stream of music?
no, it definitely put me in a box, and I was kind of insecure about all that stuff and being perceived as, just dumb punk rock kind of thing. And so, I sort of broke up the band in about 96, maybe it was, and because I wanted to go off and do other stuff, and it's just for various reasons. And sort of did a band called the Tomorrow People in the late, 97 or whatever, and did an album and a single. just so different from the mean. He's just, you know, more 60s, poppy, psychedelic sort of, I don't know. It's a bit of a hodgepodge, really, of sounds. But and I think that was quite demonstrative. Like, I really wanted to, it was me trying to prove that I could do something else, you know, and I wasn't just this idiot screaming, cutting himself on stage.
What was the most hurt you ever got? Because I just read that. I don't know any of the injuries, but it sounds like you actually got hurt a bit.
The most hurt, I've just broken lots of bones and some pretty bad lacerations. And I think one was probably more later on when I sort of cut myself with a bit of glass and just managed to get that perfect storm of glass. And it went down to the muscle in this huge fucking...
Oh, man.
I had what I like to call an arm vagina. Complete with clitoris. Like, it looked like a vagina. So that's probably the worst cut I've had. But yeah, broken jaw, feet, collarbones, blah, blah, blah. The scariest one was actually not playing. That was, I think we were touring Europe and we went to see the Hard-Ons in Italy. And me and Taz, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, linked arms and dived at the stage, and they just parted ways and we went headfirst and face planted. And he reckons he was seeing in black and white after that for like a couple of hours. And I actually was momentarily paralyzed. So I thought I'd broken my neck. So I was just lying there and couldn't move anything. And I'm just no. You know, like, it was really horrible. Just felt that cold chill get out of my body, and they dragged me off the stage, and then eventually the feeling all came back, and that was really scary.
Yeah, that reminds me, Link, that I had I do a lot. I grew up being fans of like Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and all that. And I do a lot of physical comedy, and I always erred more towards Buster Keaton because he was more like real, and Charlie Chaplin was more about like a dancer.
So is this the Beatles versus the Rolling Stones?
It is in that world. It is kind of like that. Because Buster Keaton was the genuine. He was the real deal.
He was the Rolling Stones.
It is true, but then I used to do a lot of very dangerous things to my body, and it led into the music too. I would just do crazy stuff, and then I did a show called Daredevils where we were sort of exploring our daredevil selves and like parts of ourselves. And I had to come to realize that even though in the middle of the night sometimes I would wake up complaining about aches and pains, I would do the same again. It's like it's like part of me. I couldn't even picture myself not being that sort of adventurous with my physicality and danger. Yeah. Do you feel like that? Any regrets for you? Is it all just...
Well, I don't. My body's fucked. You know, like all the joints are fucked. I don't like pain, but yeah, as you said, if I went back in time, I'd probably end up doing it just because of the kind of personality I have. You know, it's it might not be. It'd be interesting to see if I could go back in time with the mind I have now, whether the same thing would happen. It's hard to say, but definitely if I went back in time and reset, who, you know, reset.
You would repeat the same steps.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Link, one of the things I had written down, I'm going non-linear now on us, but
that's all good.
If you want to talk about this, you can, but because I don't actually have an answer for myself, but we are getting older musicians, and I had our, there's been like 13 or 14 members in Weasel, and we just had our first one pass away like last year, like one of our early drummers.
Already here.
And I was going through a lot of like what that meant to me. He wasn't in the band for years, but it was still affecting me. Did when I noticed that you lost two, like the former member, DD, Meanie, but the same year you lost Taz, who you were just talking about. One was more through like, it was cancer, more like a natural cause, and the other one was an accident. So I'm just curious. I don't even know if I have a question for that, but I'm just curious as your state of mind of like thinking of yourself as a band member. And even though this guy wasn't in the band, you're starting to lose people.
Yeah, I think it's a human thing. You know, there was some negativity in the past between me and DD. You know, there's also I had love for him, but, you know, we parted ways. And I think there's definitely a something we all do, that when you find out someone's very sick or they die or whatever, that all the positive stuff comes to the fore. And I think that's a nice thing, you know. I definitely hit harder. I think because Dee Dee did struggle with his health for many years, so it wasn't as much of a shock But with Taz, it was just a. I mean, I knew he had his. He had some issues going on, which was a worry. And I, you know, there's part of me that wishes I had done more to kind of reach out to him and whatever. But he was very insular, so that obviously that affects you more when it's still a current member of your band. Yeah, it's just very hard, as you know.
Yeah, I brought it up before to I was interviewing one of the Less Than Jake guys, and it had just happened, and so we got to start talking about death and like growing older, and with me, and I still, it's like the Steve wasn't in the band for a long time, and it's kind of like a selfish, weird thing to think, because he went down a bad path after that, but it's weird for me to think like, what did our band have anything to do with that? Like,
you know, that's cool, isn't it? You know,
yeah. And like, once again, like, could I have done anything? And then at the end of the day, I was like, I can't take that responsibility.
Well, yeah, that's it. Yeah, I mean, you got to say to yourself that, yeah, like, I can only take so much responsibility here, unless I did something very overt that led towards that person's state of mind, which I don't think I did. Hopefully. No, I can't.
Yeah.
Nothing comes to mind, but it just happens too often in bands, doesn't it? It's like, it just attracts. Loose cannons, you know, particularly punk rock, and it's just a tragedy.
I mean, I wasn't part of a rock and roll scene, you know. I grew up in that, but there is something about the punk scene that was like, I don't know, to get that energy and that risk, it did lead to a lot of people being in dangerous situations, or and also was very attractive to self-deprecating and self-destructive people.
Imagine if it was the other way around and say, like, classical music attracted those sort of people. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
You know, if Mozart jumped off his piano bench all the time. And
although you could say he was the first punk, couldn't you, really? I mean,
yeah.
All the stories to be believed. Although he sounds like a very, I read a book once of Mozart's, about it's all Mozart's letters and correspondence with people. And he did sound like he burned a lot of bridges, like he's always trying to borrow money off people and not good with money at all, and really wild. And so it's really sad. Like, it just sounded like he was almost ostracized by people, you know, towards the end, and had like a, you know, the story about the port being buried in a pauper's grave and mass grave or whatever. And you see kind of like comparisons nowadays with people that kind of like go down a bad path and just get excommunicated from the community, you know, and it's kind of sad.
What? Sorry, I'm taking a dramatic pause here. I'm hitting you with a lot of like real questions right off
that's
the bat.
Good.
So.
I prefer that. It's like it's like 70% and 80% of interviews you do are just like, oh my god. And I'm not going to say it just in case you ask me one of these questions, but there's certain questions that get asked, you know, and it's just like every time, you know.
Yeah.
I much prefer to, as bad as I am at the moment, the brain is just not firing. And that's just the way I'm very inconsistent. Sometimes it'll be like on, other times not, particularly after a nap. I'd much prefer, you know, riffing and just tangents and having a chat.
Sometimes
same
I will
way
hit,
I would be if we're out at a pub, you know.
Yeah, sometimes I will hit those basic questions, but I usually use them as jumping off points to get to something more meaningful. But what
I'm fully
why,
aware that that's done, you know?
Yeah, why I paused there is because I didn't know if it directly related to it, but I am, for someone who, like myself, who's always seeking community in a band. I mean, I had it for a while, but then that dissipated, and then it dissipated again. And I see that you have gone through different band members. And is there a part of you that craves a band, but are you also, I wouldn't say a star, but are you also an isolated unit in yourself?
I think creatively I am an isolated unit, and it took many years for me to play well with others. But I've sort of like, I have worked a little bit with other people, but I generally like to, I know what I want when I'm writing music. I find it hard to write music with other people because I have such a vivid idea of what I want out of a song. But on the other hand, I don't think I'd ever put a record out as Link McLennan and the whatever. I've always loved the idea of a band name and what it represents, you know, with, you know, it's like that unity, or just people who are in it together, as opposed to my session musos playing with me.
Do you struggle with, or have you gotten better at, or worse at, or is it better at it, at getting? Okay, here's the question, I guess. Like, there's these happy accidents, or in theater, I was really excited when I wrote a play and I brought it to the actors and they started asking questions and adding things I never would have expected.
Yeah.
In my personality, that was exciting, but I could see other people like rebelling against, or, trying to fit those people more into what they were doing. Have you vacillated between those? Have you always been one way or the other?
I think I've gotten better at it. I'd like to think that if someone comes up with something that I think is really good, then I'd say, yeah, hell yeah, that's great. It's just that quite often I don't. but I think I am more open to for instance, the band I did, Sun God Replica. The drummer in that band, is a great drummer, and he brought a lot to the songs just through, I guess I never put enough importance on the drums in some ways that it was, to me, it was all about the actual melody and the guitar and all that. And he showed me how much it can change a song, having a really good creative drummer, and it really did add a lot to the songs, which I wouldn't have put in, so I think I have gotten better at that.
Yeah, I've been pretty lucky with having really good drummers, and I learn a lot about that. Like, some of them are just like Panic from Weasel, like playing straightforward, but he was so good at it, so tight in the energy. Then there's other drummers, like my drummer in the other band, who had a jazz influenced father, but he was more of a punk rocker, but also had a bit of that, what do you call, I forgot.
Ristiness.
Yeah. But he liked a simple set. Like, he liked just two toms and that. But it was great to hear like what the hell he was going to bring into that.
Yeah. That is exciting. You got to let go, though. I mean, at first, it took a little bit of work to let go with that, at first with Lockie. But when I finally said, look, I need to do this because I think it's holding me back, holding the songs back if I'm trying to create everything, and the songs were definitely better for it.
I want to venture here because this is one I thought was interesting too, and watching your work online. Like I said, you come from the same time period of putting out music as us, and we were in the age, CDs weren't out yet, so we had that weird rebellion against CDs and barcodes. But we also had a rebellion against videos, which I didn't understand because I'm an actor theater person. It was more of like the band images that we wouldn't do that stuff. And but yours are really good. And it seems like I put down what I thought like Peter Gabriel was doing at that time too, which was like he had the money, but he was like trying to find innovators to make it,
he had great
interesting.
Clips, really good clips.
Yeah, yeah.
The one for Sledgehammer is amazing.
Yeah, but I saw flavors of that in your stuff, and you're dealing with way less budgets. So, but it seems to me like you take that stuff seriously, like that.
The guys making the clips probably took it more seriously than me. But I always hated making clips, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. Just acquaint yourself with people that were good at it, or did you have your hands in the creative aspect of those?
Well, early on, I had ideas that I wanted. Even though I found it a chore making film clips, I had ideas I wanted to do that never really sort of got used because it was kind of a case of we had these the company called Dog Boy making a lot of our early clips, and it was a trade off because they were doing cheap for us. They had kind of pretty much all the control, so I did nip a few ideas in the bud, but for the most part, I think they turned out all right. So it is what it is. It's something you got to do. It's not something I feel like I'm more gravitate more towards just doing the music, but I understand the necessity. Probably it's probably not as important nowadays, I guess. Maybe it is. I'm not sure. I don't really know how the whole industry works nowadays.
But. Yeah, it seems like it still is very important. Like every band that I talk to that's younger is like they're actually conceiving their videos almost before the song is even done.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Jesus.
I guess I'm actually surprised by that answer, because you really seem integral to those, to each one of those videos, whether it's you performing or doing something. Mm. But it's just,
well, I try and do my try and do a good performance if I'm doing it, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
But you know, as for coming up with the ideas, I really didn't come up with. I'm trying to think about. Oh, I did. we filmed a song for a clip for Wonderland, and then we had like a little bit more time, and I just said, let's just do one going down the alleyway. You know, very original idea. That was, you know, that was just more just me just not really coming up with a really great idea, but just let's do another clip. And we ended up walking down the clip alley doing that. I've done clips myself for other acts, like if a Bag Full of Bees and Bakelite Aid. So, I mean, I enjoy the process of actually just sitting there on my computer and putting shit together. Like, I've done a lot of animated ones for Bag Full of Bees. So I kind of like that idea, but in terms of rocking up and doing a performance, I don't feel 100% comfortable with that, but I'll do it.
Yeah. No, I thought that you just been fairly lucky, I guess, or just with the right people. Cause I thought, I mean, almost all the ones I watched, I really liked. Like the one, well, the more recent one a couple of years ago was with the air blowing at you, probably right. Your mouths are all expanding. And
then there's
the weird, like, it looks like everyone's together in front of the white, but everyone had to be done separately. Cause there's like strange things happening to like,
no, where the legs are twisting and shit
Yeah.
You know, we were just all together when we were doing that. I don't know how. So with the wizardry of Windows Movie Maker, I remembered that was kind of pretty shitty. The leaf blowers they used.
Was that what they used?
Yeah, but I don't think they'd been cleaned properly. So it's like grit, shit flying into your mouth and it was like into your eyes. It was fucking horrible, but it does look good.
Some of them that I feel like have that a little bit of a Monty Python feel to me, like, but that's how I related to like the cutout figurines and stuff. You had a couple
there's
at least one or two that had that.
There's the one we did for Buffalo Free, which just had a head superimposed over all kind of 70s footage, and then there's the one that was like the animated one with the cutout kind of stuff. I think there's anything I do is generally going to have a sense of humor about it, because I don't feel I can pull off serious, you know. Or I just feel a bit embarrassed. I mean, I have done some serious clips, but once again, it was someone else's idea, you know. Like there's one crawling around the cellar for the Bakelite Age, which I kind of look back and feel a little uncomfortable about because it looks all seems a little bit too kind of like
too precious.
Well, a little bit too emotional. Yeah.
Yeah. That seems like another element of punk that I sometimes have disagreements with. And even maybe if it's, once again, it's our age, whether we're Generation X or whatever, but that where irony is so strong that it's hard to feel something emotionally without criticizing it at the same time. I have like a love-hate relationship with that.
Yeah.
I sometimes try to fight it and I'll purposely say things that are like, not overdramatic, just emotional.
Yeah, it's funny how some people are so comfortable with that sort of stuff. And I guess it's a shortcoming. Maybe it's a shortcoming of my personality, or maybe it's I don't take life that seriously. I don't know. It's interesting, though, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I guess I wouldn't even put like whether it makes someone more creative or less creative or good, because it seems like something good comes out of both of those. Like this.
Yeah. Of course, shit I love that's very emotional. And I'll look at something and think, oh, that's fabulous. I could never do that, though, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd feel embarrassed kind of like trying to pull that off, you know.
Yeah. Do you cry at all on movies when you watch movies?
Yeah, I do, yeah. All the time.
Me too.
I'm fucking over it.
I'm a sap with romantic comedies. I used to say that if I threw my shoe at the TV, that was probably a good romantic comedy, because I just get so
You should be going out with my partner. She's made me watch a few rom-coms. And
it's fun because my girlfriend of now 4 years now is Japanese. She's from here. And I try to introduce her to those. And sometimes you forget Western. I mean, throw in Australia, European and America into that. But forget that there's some references and ways of culture of being that they just don't. that they don't get at all. And
Yeah, yeah,
some of
yeah,
them,
yeah.
are like hit her hard, and some of them I'm like, she just doesn't care. Like I did,
Yeah.
what's that one called? That is my favorite movie. I was almost emotionally scarred by her not liking it. But it was, oh, When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, right. I've never, still never seen it.
I
Yeah.
love that movie to death.
It's
And
my type of film normally, yeah.
while we were watching it, I realized like, oh, this is, you kind of have to know a New York Jew and a lot of the jokes. And but at the end, she was just like stone face.
I've had that experience many times about films. Like, the shit that I'm just raving to them about for days, and then we finally watch. Just like, well, they do that noise, but it's yeah, the humor thing though is like, I was, as I said, I was married to a Spanish girl, and she spoke very good English. But there's just some finer points of maybe a style of humor from where you're from that will just go over the head, you know, and it can be frustrating when you're watching like your favorite comedy and it's just not,
Yeah,
and you're
yeah.
looking at them, they're just like staring at the TV.
Here's an interesting question for you that I don't think I've ever asked this before, because I don't have a weird relationship with it. I purposely have never really dated people that know my music or anything.
Okay.
Is there any kind of goal in you where
You
you did
bring that up on the first date? You my music?
I asked
Have to go.
that. Well, I did date someone who I eventually found out that they did know about the band, and I didn't know that. And I'm not going to not talk to somebody because they know my band, but I just
Yeah.
it's and I don't know why that is about myself. I just maybe it's because I got to enough of a point of what I call semi-fame where sometimes I really have to I question my relationships to see if they're real over time, you know, like.
Yeah, right. I think that'd be like the worst end of that sort of thing would be being a multi-millionaire.
Oh
I mean,
yeah, exactly.
how would you ever trust kind of your
Yeah,
relationship, you
no,
know?
okay. That's
You'd have to go to a, I don't know, bloody, it's like an island somewhere that's, you know, like natives living there, and very one of the local girls who, you know, has never been to fucking America.
yeah. No, I think that's one of the things where I don't think I ever really want to be super famous, but everything I do is like artistic related. So that's part of me, part of it in me. But I think
Yeah.
part of it that I've come to pretty happy with is that I like my anonymity in some ways, that I could
Yeah,
just
yeah, yeah.
like I'll have a friend that doesn't know the band, but then that friend's best friend is like a insane friend, a insane fan, and they'll come up, my friend will come up and say, you know, I didn't even know you were like that big of a deal. And I kind of like that. I know if I can handle being like super famous and having, you
I
know,
think it'd be horrible, to be
yeah.
honest. You know, it's like, it's something that I probably would have liked when I was younger, just for many reasons, like money, you know, just
Yeah.
security, whatever.
Yeah.
Not that I ever did music for that reason, but and also the ego when you're younger, but it's something that I think would be absolutely horrid nowadays, you know.
Yeah. Well, here that kind of leads me in a little bit of a segue to, I was curious about that. What, you know, you can read articles and then it's not the same on the inside. Like, of course you were doing other bands, but there is a big gap of time with the Meanies, right? That were completely inactive, right?
Well, that not as much as some people think,
Yeah,
because we did,
that's why I ask, because it's often not
yeah,
as clear as
it
it
was probably
seems.
about 4 years, 4 or 5 years maybe.
Yeah.
And then we sort of got back together again, and then we sort of just like shuffled along for without really much plan for another, you know, 10 years or something. And people kind of, at the end of that 10 years of shuffling along, people are like, oh, you guys are back together, you know. It's like,
Yeah, you have like a lot of 7 inches, but actually, as technical going in the studio records, you only have four over a long period of time. So,
Four albums, is it?
is
Hold on.
that's what I saw? Am I correct? Let me look. I wrote them down.
What
I
do we
think.
got? We got Gang
Come
on
and
This,
See,
In Search Of,
10%.
Come and See.
Yeah.
In Search Of and Gang on This are kind of like eight tracks, records.
Okay. Yeah.
And pretty short, but so not really albums, I guess. But
Yeah.
even our albums are pretty short. But yeah, probably four albums proper, I guess.
Do you believe in conceptual records? Like, even if you're not intentionally doing so, do you feel like your records are conceptual in some way? Do they like mark a period of time, or do they mark
No, I don't think
a
at
thought
all. No,
process? Huh?
I don't think at all. Yeah,
Yeah.
individual songs thrown together.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as I kind of like the idea of that, I did toy with the idea of doing a rock opera once about this guy who's not blind or deaf and he's really shit at pinball, and I was going to call it Timmy, but it didn't happen. Well, I seriously started writing it, but it's just like the joke only had like so much that you could do.
So I wasn't off by throwing in the Pete Townsend reference.
No.
One thing that stopped me from being an all-out Who fan is I just didn't like Roger Daltrey. I didn't.
What, the latter day of Roger Daltrey, the open chest.
Yeah, in general, I just didn't get him. And then I
prefer the early day Roger Daltrey. I thought he was super cool, you know, for the mod era Roger Daltrey. But it's funny hearing Pete Townsend talk about that stuff, you know, despise Roger Daltrey with his shirt open. His beautiful, long, beautiful locks.
It kicked it up for me when I heard I bought the Scoop records, you know, the Pete Townsend Scoop. I don't know if you heard of those. They're like his home recordings of all like the Who songs. And
I haven't heard him
sing them, I was like, oh, that's where it is for me. I like that.
Yeah, right. I love listening to the interviews with Pete Townsend because he's like he just comes across as so bitter. but he doesn't like anything anyone else did. You know, it's like Keith Moon. I didn't think he was a good drummer. You know, blah blah blah. And it's like, and it's so funny because like Keith Moon's drumming was such. You can't think of a drummer who was more important to a band. You know. No one was doing drum rolls in the middle of verses. It really changed the dynamic. He was more like, it was kind of like he was doing classical music sometimes, you know. It was just incredible.
It's weird that you say that. I didn't hear Pete Townsend say that, because one of the comments I often bring up to like drummers on the show or people talking about bands is how Pete Townsend said it. I think it's in the long documentary they did on The Who, where he talks about when Keith Moon died, it didn't really hit him that hard. You know, they were going to move on. They got a new drummer.
Yeah.
But he said what it did was, he had this moment where he was feeling the energy of the moment, the spontaneity of Pete Townsend, and he went to hit something and he looked at the drums and saw it wasn't Keith. And
yeah,
it just fell flat. It fell flat because he didn't have that person that understood what he was, where he was going.
Yeah. It says a lot about his personality that he got hit creatively rather than kind of like emotionally.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe he's a great guy. I don't know, but
Great that you're close to Jay, and I think Jay is great. I'm happy I just met him, and he told me that you guys are opening for him. Do you have any ego? Were you wounded at all that you are now opening up for someone that was like looked up to you, or is that a point of pride for you, or what? This is any kind
totally,
of
totally yeah. jealous.
Thank you.
Well, the meanies kind of like have headlined over quite a few bands that have gone on to bigger and better things, that you kind of feel a bit like the decline of the Western Civilization, the Metal Years.
That band
London. Yeah. We're a bit like London, you know.
How long has London been together?
Too fucking long.
This is 1979. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, this is like the training school for rock stars.
Yeah.
So he's like, we get somebody in the band, and
as soon as they leave, they become rock stars.
So who else has been in the band?
A couple of dudes from Guns N' Roses, a dude from Wasp, and Nikki Sixx of Motley Crue, Freddie Corey of Cinderella.
To be honest, I'm happy for them. You know, they're very talented band, whatever, and a really nice bunch of guys. So, like, why not? I mean, you see so many shit bands getting famous that if a good one gets famous, well, good.
Yeah, that seems good. I mean, I hear similar things about their performance that I've heard about yours, that they're just really exciting to watch.
They're great. Really, and much better musicians than we are, too.
Yeah. Well, I guess my question is trying to dig at, because I hear often as a view as being an influence on other bands, and I know I don't have a difficult time with that relationship. Like there's bands that are influenced by us that I like and don't like. Like I don't like Blink 182, but I, you know, and I don't really like Green Day much, but
nah.
I think there's one out there I like.
We would get on so well. Sometimes I feel like such a grumpy old so-and-so, you know, I just like,
yeah.
I just see so many bands, you know, and I really don't think I'm being bitter. I really want to like bands, but there's so few bands that really do it the way I want to hear it, you know. I want to hear bands that make me feel like Syd Barrett made me feel, you know. It made me feel like I didn't know where the song was going. I don't like going to see a band and knowing where the next. I go and see bands and I know where every chord is going. You know, I'm sure you've done the same thing. You go, right.
I went to my friends in this band called the Mangies, who I really love. They do the Ramones thing pretty good. They're like dead on. Almost COD or OCD about it, but I went to their club and they're just, it was a dance club, and I just happened to be sitting there with my guitar because I think we were playing soon, and I was able to play every song that I heard, even though I never heard them before. I could go with every chord that they, and I'm not a great guitarist at all, it just seemed, it was the same. They were all doing the same exact thing.
And I get it that that seems to be a thing with people that attracts people to bands, that they like that comfort zone, I guess. It's just not where my brain's at. I kind of like to be shocked with music and like to, you know, feel like I'm in a car thinking I'm going left and the car goes right, that feeling, you know.
And these last two records, once again, my caveat is that I really like these last two records, I think.
Oh, thank you.
In my style of music, listening to your whole catalog, those last two are, they hit me good.
And I cringe at some of the old stuff, you know, to be honest.
I think I did this with Even in Blackouts too, where I wanted the songs to sound simple, but there's more going on underneath. Like, do you feel like these songs are falling under that more Ramonesy and 70s? Are you playing with any intricacies that a listener wouldn't know or doesn't need to know?
I don't think there's much in the way of kind of guitar wise, and there's not that much in the way of kind of like noodling within the structure.
Yeah,
but I think the structures can actually probably deceptively complex in some of the songs, like, you know, Hell of a Lot of Changes, and I just think maybe, as I said, talking about Syd Barrett and whatever, the way I construct a melody is maybe sort of like works against the rhythm or whatever, but it's maybe a bit different.
Yeah, the way you sing over it too doesn't, because sometimes music that isn't, sometimes falls under that, what I call, where someone's singing to the chord changes instead.
A high school band.
Or like an old hardcore band, which is really hate you, I really hate you, I like,
I am following the root note, I am following the root note. Yeah, I can't stand that. I'd never like that.
It's just because we did say about, and I like a lot of those Ramonesy type bands, but I can get really tired of it. But there is, it does seem like you add a little element to it that it pulls it a little bit out of being those like Ramones bands or something. And you've been around a long time. But so I wouldn't call it one of those, but you're definitely playing with that sound a lot. Like,
I think definitely. Earlier on, more so than, you know, the last couple of records, but there's always a little bit of that element. But there's some songs which are quite obviously very heavily influenced by the Ramones and the earlier stuff. But you know, it's like you could say it's the Saints, you could say it's the Damned, a lot of bands, you know, just like flat out chords, melodic change, or whatever. Maybe it seems a bit more like that because of my voice. I sort of got a bit of a honking voice. That is probably sometimes not super dissimilar from Joe Ramone, but I'm comfortable with what anyone wants to see in it. You know, I think it's more complicated than stuff like that.
Like I said, I've just dived in, but I would say, because I had that inclination too, and I think what you have that's like different from Joey is that even though he's influenced by 60s and 70s, your flair of singing seems to come more from that on top of the punk Ramonesy sound, like, than him. Like, he was more in the present 80s, 90s singing. Like, you're combining more a little bit that 60s feel on top of it.
But you can sort of definitely, even with Joe Ramone, in certain songs, you can definitely see that kind of influence from the, you know, soul influence. And I think in some of the stuff he does, particularly if he's doing a soul cover, you know, like Baby, I Love You.
Tell me that you feel the same.
But yeah, no, it's as I said, that's my hands down my favorite era of music, and my biggest influence is the 60s, then the 70s. Oh, yeah, I skipped the 50s. I mean, there's some of that stuff which I like, but yeah, if I could go back and visit an era and start a band, it would be the 60s. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is your plan now to are you just going at it? an aging easy pace now, or are you trying to like tack or have I'd you found like a resurgence? Are these grouping of shows like leading to something more consistent, or it's a weird question, like, because I think I know the answer. I'm just curious as to
I'd say I'm going at a kind of my spirit has been crushed kind of pace. And I'm kind of happy with that because it's more conducive to writing good music. You know, like the less you care about success, the freer your brain is to actually explore, and without all those kind of forces pulling and tugging at you and directing you and whatever. So I write a more purer sort of music now, you know?
Oh.
More organic.
Yeah. Wow, I like that answer. I wasn't expecting that, but I like it.
I love writing music more than I ever have. So yeah. I'll never stop doing that. But in terms of the game, yeah, as it were, I'm pretty cynical about it and don't really care. And I'm happy not to. You know?
I'll ask you a question that I asked Dr. Frank, who is from the Mr. T Experience. I don't know if you know them. They were from another Lookout band with Green Day and all that. But
right.
He's always writing songs, like always putting out songs. He doesn't seem to care who like listens to him. But I asked him, I was like, I usually don't like these what ifs, but I had said like, okay, what if no one cared anymore at all? Mm. Would you still be sitting there with your guitar writing songs? And he said, I mean, he didn't even pause. He just said, yes, of course. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's it. I agree. I actually write. It's such a funny thing. I write music to impress myself now. You know, it's kind of almost like someone else is writing it in some way. I know that sounds like a really kind of corny, but I want to blow myself away with what I've written, and that's kind of more important to me. Of course, I want other people to like it, but don't get me wrong, there's still, you're never going to fully get rid of that, but I really knuckle down now and just really work really hard at just creating something that is so undeniably good, you know, particularly with this Bag Full of Bees stuff. You know, the new album's got ready to go, we're still waiting to get it done. Is, you know, I just easily the best shit I've ever written. You know, so, the first Bag Full of Bees album was a little disparate, I guess, in terms of kind of didn't quite have the continuity that I would have liked. I think the next one is, I've sort of gotten there with it, so I can't wait to get that out.
Is there a, now we'll get to the brass tacks, is there a place that I can guide this audience to so that they know when that comes out or how to?
The Cheer Squad Records. Put out our first album. I think they're putting it, hopefully they're putting out the next one. So yeah, you can just visit their site.
I guess I'm not confused anymore because I read another interview, but it was interesting that you, the last record, Desperate Measures,
yeah,
on your site, it said it was released recently, but then I looked back and it was actually done, released a while ago, but then the pandemic happened, right?
We put it out and then 2 years later, we actually toured it.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of okay because you've got a double go at it, you know. And you could justify it.
You know what I did? I did. I hit all the things I wanted to hit.
Oh, cool. All in under an hour.
Yeah, well, hour 14 to be exact.
Oh, okay. But
I will throw one more thing at you that you may not have anything to say to, but I guess I was reading an interview about the last record, and as a lot of us did over the pandemic, politics started invading our thinking and the worry about the world the way it is now. And I did an interview with, I don't know if you're familiar with this band called Born Against, which are a hardcore band out of America. The Sam McFeeters is a writer, but he wrote this article about how, and I thought about this too, about how when we were younger, like our age is when the Weekly World News and all of those like extreme, did you get the Weekly World News like in Australia? That magazine that was all fake stories?
Oh, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, the movie Repo Man riffs on that, like, you know, Bat Boy and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, right. Okay.
But we were really into that, whether it's ironically, and some people believe it, but a lot of that, I feel, like this modern age is like a reflection of that. Like it's gone rampant, like this,
like the National Enquirer kind of.
Yeah, like this wanting or needing to believe in extreme thoughts and ideas just seems to be permeating. I felt like we got a little glimpse of it back then, like when it was just like a, I don't know, just a just beginning to brew.
Yeah, it's funny because it, like there's a kind of like a section of, you know, of people that were kind of like not really taken seriously and just kind of like we just had a bit of a chuckle about, and then suddenly they've sort of became a force. And you know, Donald Trump kind of like was like you know, standing there with a flag and they're all coming to him. And yeah, it was just a really scary time, wasn't it? Or still is, but
yeah.
But he's caused irreparable damage to the world. You know, well, I guess nothing's irreparable, but he's caused a lot of damage to the world. As did other people who followed his lead. You know, our former prime minister. You know, just some really disgusting, gaslighting, despicable people. You know, it's like how the fuck did this happen? It still blows my mind.
Mm. Do you? I know we've talked a little bit about how you went through and you were critical about yourself younger, that you probably weren't easy to be around. Mm. Do you feel like you've become, or have you always been a genuine person? Like, do you think you're a genuine person?
I think I am a genuine person. I think my insecurity when I was younger caused me to behave badly and do things I'm not proud of. But I'd like to think now that I am a very genuine person, and I'm not swayed by anything, whereas I might have been when I was younger. Mm. Swayed by kind of like, you know, I'm not, wouldn't say popular opinion, but swayed by my momentum of a moment, or
yeah,
100%. Not explaining very well, but.
No.
Yes, I'm genuine. Would you say you are?
I always thought I was, and then something pretty horrible happened in my life. I'm of my own doing.
Yeah.
And I started to question all of those years of
yeah.
So I'm not sure right now. I know I'm trying to be. I'm trying to be a little bit more honest with myself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it all goes back to, you know, things like like, for instance, the question of, is being a good person ultimately just as selfish as being a classical selfish person?
You know? Yeah,
doing
yeah.
something nice for someone, isn't that just about yourself, making yourself feel good, blah, blah, blah. So what is genuine? I mean, to me, I'd rather be selfish and do nice things for people and make myself feel good. And I'm pretty comfortable with the fact that there's not this kind of pure altruism, you know, that's kind of a little bit, I feel like it's a little bit fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
But
I'm right there with you. That's how I believe too. Yeah. Cause some people say, oh, you do something for someone else, it's still a selfish act. I go, well, yeah, might be, but you're still doing something for someone else.
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's better than doing something just for yourself.
Yeah.
Hey, we're a kind of failed experiment. You've got to take the best you can take, and that's what it is, you know. So, I probably didn't mention, I'm a bit of a misanthrope and nihilist. So.
Well, you got a little humor towards it, though. So that's
I'm not do it with a lot of conviction. You know, mm-hmm. It's like I do some analysis, but I do love my friends and family with a passion, and I don't want to see anything really bad happen to the world. But at the same time, intellectually, I'm a nihilist.
Yeah, I would probably say intellectually, I'm probably more of a, I guess that, what would be the opposite, a positivist? But I am an existentialist, though. I think, like, I really do believe the now is what we have, and
that's the thing. I'm not consistent. I can be like that too, but that's why I said intellectually I'm a nihilist.
Yeah,
but
emotionally,
you know, that can be a quick, completely different thing. You know,
well, yeah. The emotions. That's another beast for another podcast.
Those emotions.
All right, Link, I'm going to let you go, but I had a
no
great
worries,
time.
Mate.
And look, I did
Thank
exa-
you very much.
1 hour, 20 minutes.
Wow,
that's
exactly
what I said to you. So.
Oh, you did say 1 hour, 20 minutes.
I did.
Fabulous. Amazing.
All right, so when I hang up, it's a real hang up. So I'm
gonna, all right.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, mate. That was a lot of fun.
All right. Thanks for talking to
Sorry,
me.
Sorry, I wasn't as fluid as I would have liked it to be.
It was great. I was great. It was great. Cool. I'll make you sound even greater.
All right. Good on ya.
Bye bye bye.
Thanks,
bye.
Bye bye.
And your family and whoever happens to be listening just heard Cruel to be Caned by the Meanies off their 2020 record Desperate Measures. Thank you everybody for listening. Remember, go to that Patreon at www.jugheadsbasementpossum.com. I don't know what you'll find if you go there, let me know, but go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. Please do this. If you really enjoy the show, please share it with other people. Let's grow this thing so that I can be interviewing until my dying days. That would be great. Upcoming episodes include Brett from Australia's Dune Rats and my long-awaited second interview with Jesse Michaels, where we talk about spirituality, art, his new band with Tim Armstrong, plus much more, of course. So, see you there in the audio world, where what is seen must be imagined. And what is imagined is what is seen. You know, if you say things like that, they sound really profound. Like I could just say, bottom is top, but the top is the bottom. So, goodbye, or goodbye is so.